Let's go ahead and call the...
Chair Fawn.
Here.
Representatives Persons Mulica.
Here.
Salzman.
Here.
Skidmore, excused. Amnesty.
Here.
Anderson.
Here.
Baker.
Here.
Clemens.
Here.
Cross.
Here.
Dunkley.
Here.
Edmonds.
Here.
Gant.
Here.
Grant.
Here.
Coster.
Here.
Masula.
Here.
Plankin.
Here.
Rizzio. Rizzio. Snyder.
Here.
Tribuzzi.
Here.
Woodson.
Yeah.
Yakarski.
Here.
Quorum is present.
Thank you, Sabrina. As we begin the meeting, I ask everyone to make sure your cell phone is set to vibrate. I want to welcome each of you to our first meeting of the Health and Human Services Subcommittee, and I want to start by thanking Speaker Renner for entrusting me with this responsibility. It's something that I am very much looking forward to. I'll share a little bit about me when we get to the point when we do that. But before we start, I want folks to know this committee has a broad authority over all health care and human services, as well as welfare in the state of Florida. Our jurisdiction includes Medicaid, facility and professional regulation, public health, mental health and substance abuse, child welfare, health insurance, and many other complex areas. We cover 8 different state agencies in total or in part. Those are the Department of Children and Families, the Agency for Healthcare Administration, the Department of Health, the Agency for Persons with Disabilities, the Department of Elder Affairs, the Department of Veterans Affairs as it relates to veterans' nursing home issues, the Office of Insurance Regulation as it relates to health insurance coverage policy, and the Department of Management Services as it reflects the State Employee Group Health Plan policy. So those last three, it's partial. Those of you who sit on the subcommittees are getting presentations in detail on each of those jurisdictions. We'll be tackling some very interesting issues this session, and I'm really looking forward to working with each of you over the next 2 years. We're going to start with introductions in a minute, but as we do that, I ask that everyone keep 2 things in mind as we move forward. They're the same 2 things that I told the committees that I chaired the last 4 years that will be the case here in healthcare as well. 2 things I ask everyone to keep in mind. The first is that everything is on the table. The good news, we'll talk about my experience in healthcare in a little while, which is 0. And so as a result, I don't know what happened last year or in the past. Everything is on the table. I don't believe in just because something has been done this way for 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 years, it inherently should be done that way in the future. I made a living back when I worked for a living breaking the way things had been done for a long time and rebuilding them in a better way. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is I will tell you something very simple. Good ideas will win. So if you have a good idea that you prove with a fact pattern that supports it, it will win the day, and that is how we will move forward. With those 2 things in mind, I want to let everyone introduce themselves before we get to our presentation today. And we are going to start with our Vice Chair, Representative Persons Mulica.
Thank you, Chair Fine. I'm Jenna Persons Mulica, and I represent House District 78. It includes the entire city of Fort Myers and a large portion of Lee County. And Chair Fine, it's truly a pleasure to be able to serve with you. I'm excited for your leadership, and I'm excited to serve with this entire committee as your vice chair this year. Like Chair Fine, I served on this committee the past 2 years, but prior to that, I had 0 healthcare experience. Now I probably have enough to be dangerous, but still not enough to know everything. But I can share with you that diving into this new world has been an incredibly rewarding experience. What we will learn, what we will tackle, knowing the impact that you're having on every Floridian in our state is just, it's absolutely incredible. So I look forward to tackling these issues together, these issues of critical state concern and concern to our constituents. So thank you.
You can just go in a circle. I'm not going to recognize everybody.
Got it. Hi, Tracy Coster, House District 66 in Hillsborough, Northwest Hillsborough County. And I'm excited to be here, and I'm excited to serve as chair of one of your subcommittees.
Representative Grant, District 75, which is
the western part of Charlotte County and the southwestern part of Sarasota County. Served on this committee for many years and look forward to your leadership, Chair Fine, as we explore new ways of doing things into the future. Thank you.
Rep. Masullo, I serve in District 23, and I've been on this committee a couple times, and it's an honor to serve with you, Rep. Fine, and I'm excited about the adventure that you're going to take us on.
Hello, Alex Rizzo, District 112, Northwest Miami-Dade County, Hialeah, Florida, Miami Springs, Virginia Gardens, and portions of City of Miami. This is my second term and second term serving on this committee, and I love serving under the great leadership that we have here with Rep. Fine, Rep. Persons Mullica, and our ranking member, and I look forward to serving with every single one of you. Thank you.
I'm Chuck Clemens. I represent District 22, which is parts of Alachua County, all of Levy and Gilchrist County, and I'm just pleased to be here and looking forward to learning from my colleagues and the tutelage of Chairman Fine.
Thank you, Chair. And my name is Dana Trabolsi. I am serving District 84, which is St. Lucie County. This is my second term. I have limited experience with healthcare, although I sat on healthcare appropriations last year. I am looking forward to this committee, working under the leadership of Chair Fine, and on a topic that, quite frankly, each one of us can resonate with, which is good quality healthcare. So, looking forward to it.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Fine. My name is Taylor Yarkowski. I represent District 25, which is Northwest Orlando area, primarily Claremont, Montverde, Groveland, Howie in the Hills. And I'm a freshman. This is an honor to be on this committee. Like Chair Fine, I am a businessman, and so I'm excited to bring some common sense business approach to fixing a lot of issues that I know we're going to dive into, and I'm grateful to serve with a lot of senior colleagues. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair. I am Lindsay Cross, serving District 60 in Pinellas County. This includes portions of St. Petersburg, Pinellas Park, and unincorporated Lilman District. I'm really excited to serve under both the chair, the vice chair, and our ranking member. I'm the daughter of a long-distance runner, and so health and wellness has always been a part of my childhood and growing up. I'm also fortunate to have several excellent healthcare systems and hospitals in my district and want to be a strong advocate for our staff, our doctors, our patients. I'm also a yoga instructor, so I'm always looking for ways to increase health and vitality for all of our residents in our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jessica Baker. I represent District 17. It's in Jacksonville. I represent the southeast portion of Duval County. I do not have any experience in healthcare, but I am looking forward to serving on this committee and learning, and it's an honor to be here. Thank you.
Good afternoon, and thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Carolina Amnesty, and I represent District 45, which is parts of Orange and Osceola County in Central Florida, cities like Gotha, Ocoee, Windermere, Winter Garden, Kissimmee, Davenport, and Champion Skate. It is an honor to serve on this committee. My background is education, so I'm not too familiar with health and human services, but I look forward to working on this committee and working under the leadership of Chair Fine. Thank you.
Well, good evening, everyone. My name is Gervonta Edmonds, and I am proud to serve District 88, which is Palm Beach County, West Palm Beach, Riviera Beach, Palm Beach Gardens, Royal Palm Beach, Lake Park, and Mangonia Park. And I'm sure everything will be fine under our new leadership. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Marie Woodson, and I represent District 105 in South Broward County, which is parts of Hollywood, Pembroke Pines, Miramar, Hollandale, West Park, and Pembroke Park. As a former public administrator, I have worked in the field of health and human services. I look forward to working under Chair Fine, the vice chair, and the ranking member, and all my colleagues in order to better the lives of Floridians. Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ashley Gant, and I have the pleasure of representing my home, District 109 in Miami-Dade County. And I also have Jackson Memorial Hospital and University of Miami Hospitals in my district. So it is a pleasure and honor to be on this committee. with the chair, vice chair, and the ranking member. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Adam Anderson. I represent North Pinellas County. I'm a proud father of three, a small business owner. my experience with healthcare is strictly from a personal level. I've had a child with a rare disease. I had my more than my fair share of exposure to the healthcare system, you know, both good and bad. And also being self-employed, was not ever fortunate in my life to have an employer-sponsored plan. Actually, it's the first time in my life I've had one as a freshman state rep, which is awesome. So I do have some experience from the health insurance side as well, and what it's like to make those decisions from a personal level and also for my business. So I'm looking forward to sharing some of those thoughts in a way that can be beneficial to all Floridians. Very proud to be here. Thank you.
Hi, good afternoon, and thank you, Chair, for this opportunity. My name is Lisa Dunkley, and I'm proud to represent District 97 down there in Broward County, which covers Lauderhill, Lauderdale Lakes, North Lauderdale Plantation, Tamarack, parts of Fort Lauderdale as well, and I think my city, my home city, Sunrise. I don't have experience on the health purview, but I am looking forward to listening, learning from my colleagues, and working with everyone so we can have a stellar healthcare system here in Florida for everyone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, Ranking Member. Great to be here. My name is John Snyder. I represent District 86, which covers most of Martin County and a portion of Northern Palm Beach, and excited to get to work. Thank you.
My name is Rachel Plakin, and I represent District 36, which is Northern Seminole County. And I'm really honored to be part of this committee, and I'm just looking forward to working with Chair Fine and our Vice Chair and Ranking Member.
Well, thank you, and I'm Randy Fine. I represent the 33rd District of the Florida House, which is Southern Brevard County. I am no longer a businessman, whoever said that. I'm a retired entrepreneur. I have two jobs. The most important one is I'm the father of two boys, Jacob, who is 14, and David, who is 11. If you haven't heard about them, you will, because I talk about them a lot, to their great anger. But in addition to that, my other job is I'm a pre-calculus tutor for my son Jacob. So those are those. And if you ever see me run out of here, it's because I'm getting a call with emergency help on a pre-calculus problem. So I'm looking forward to this, to being on this committee. I have never been on the committee before. I don't mind sharing what I know and what I don't know. In my 6 years in the legislature, I've served on two healthcare subcommittees. I asked to be taken off of both after 1 year. So this is as new to me as it gets, but I'm very excited because we have fresh perspective of people like me, but we also have people who've dedicated their lives to the industry, like Leader Grant and Chair Masullo, who will bring that perspective that will help guide us and help lead us as well. I know a lot of people said they're looking forward to working with me, but I'm looking forward to working with all of you, and I think a lot of the leadership and what we do over the next 2 years won't come from the person sitting in this chair. Other thing I can promise you is it will not be boring. If any of you have followed me the last 2 years, my committee meetings never are. Speaking of that, we're going to move on to what we're here to talk about today. Let's get started with our agenda, which is a Medicaid overview and a briefing on Medicaid redeterminations. We're going to hear from the Agency for Healthcare Administration and the Department of Children and Families. Members, federal changes to the state Medicaid program during the pandemic caused a massive increase in enrollment, as we'll hear in a few minutes, including many people who don't qualify or don't anymore qualify for Medicaid coverage. To make it simple, the federal government during the pandemic said, once you're on, it's like being on the Supreme Court. You can't get kicked off. And so we have people who qualified at one moment in time, but do not qualify today, and we'll get some estimates for what that number is today. Recently, Congress took action to allow states to start disenrolling these unqualified people. We're here today to hear the plan for making that happen in Florida. Let me talk about why this matters. I've said this a lot over the last 4 years. I'll say it a lot, but we have a fixed pot of money to work with here in the state. We have unlimited wants and limited means. And every dollar that we spend on someone who does not qualify for a benefit is a dollar that we cannot spend on someone who does need it. It's a limited amount of money, and we'll get into that more as the presentation goes on. We're joined today by Tom Wallace, the Deputy Secretary for Medicaid at the Agency for Healthcare Administration, and Casey Penn, Assistant Secretary for Economic Self-Sufficiency at DCF. Mr. Wallace and Mr. Penn will present an overview of the state Medicaid program and a briefing on the plan to move back to normal Medicaid eligibility and to disenroll unqualified recipients. I'm going to ask you to hold your questions until the end of their presentation, but as this is our only item that we're hearing today, whenever they're done, the rest of the time, we will have four questions. Secretary Wallace and Secretary Penn, you are recognized.
Thank you, Chair, Vice Chair, and members of the committee. Proud to be here today. This is my fourth committee meeting presenting today, so some of you have seen earlier today. You might see some slides that are familiar, but I do have some other details in here. So, Mr. Chairman, I've kind of saved the best presentation for last here of the day.
If we good answer.
All right. So, first here, just start off about Medicaid in general. Little overview on Medicaid. Medicaid was created in 1965 by Congress as a Title 19 of the Social Security Act. Each state's Medicaid program is going to be looked different. You know, once the federal minimum requirements are met, but you take a little survey of all state Medicaid programs throughout the nation, and they're all different. Never seen one that's the same. States can choose whether or not to have a Medicaid program, and currently all states and all territories have a Medicaid program. State Medicaid programs are jointly financed by both the state and federal governments. So once a Medicaid program is enacted, both the federal and state governments will put in their share of the costs and expenditures associated with that program. Our Medicaid program here in Florida began 53 years ago in 1970. So for each dollar that the Medicaid program spends, the federal government contributes a portion, like I mentioned here. For medical services, that portion is determined by a FMAP formula. And so FMAP is the Federal Medical Assistance Percentage. It's also known as FFP, Federal Financial Participation. It's essentially the federal share of what the federal government will put in to match the state dollars. And so how this is determined based off this formula, it looks like, essentially compares the state's per capita income to the national per capita income. And the higher the state's per capita income, the lower that FMAP will be. The current FMAP for Florida is sitting here. This is without the public health emergency or the PHE rate enhancement, and we'll talk about that in a little bit here, but without that, it's 60.05%. And so this means that for every dollar that is spent on Medicaid, the federal government puts in 60.05 cents on that dollar, and the state will pay the remaining portion. So as long as states meet federal requirements, they can choose how to structure their state Medicaid programs. And so they can choose what delivery system to use for their Medicaid enrollees that are eligible for the program. So in Florida, the vast majority of the people are in our statewide Medicaid Managed Care Program, or SMMC program. So they are in those programs, in those managed care plans, to receive their health care benefits. They receive full benefits, and so what that means is that all Medicaid benefits are such as hospital, primary care, physician, behavioral health services, or whatnot here, a person receives those full benefits. Whatever that service needs, they can get. About 95% of the Medicaid recipients receive the full benefits. We also have limited benefits. 5% are in a limited benefits, and that is an individual that would fall into, let's say, our family planning waiver, where that individual would only get family planning services and that's it. They would not be entitled to the other Medicaid benefits. So currently, Medicaid covers more than 25% of Floridians. Really, it's right at that 25%. So one in every four Floridians is going to be on the Medicaid program essentially today. So this program serves adults who are low-income parents and pregnant women, as well as low-income elderly and disabled persons. Since Florida Medicaid covers a significant percentage of the populations of children and pregnant women, the Medicaid program has the opportunity to really impact health outcomes throughout our program. And so of that 5.5 million, it's really over 5.5 today, it's roughly 5.6, but of that number there, we got roughly 2.6 million individuals that are adults, and these are parents, elderly folks, and disabled. 54% of the children in Florida are covered on the Medicaid program. About 54% of the births, or really deliveries in Florida, are covered by Medicaid, and 60% of nursing home days are Medicaid reimbursed. So not everyone is eligible to enroll in Florida Medicaid. So first, the person has to be in a covered group to enroll. Then the person must meet some technical requirements, such as residing in the state of Florida or intend to reside in Florida. They also need to be a U.S. citizen. And if they don't have U.S. citizenship yet, there is some non-citizen statuses that they could have. And then also they need to apply for a Social Security number. And finally, the final requirement to become Medicaid eligible is to meet certain income thresholds. And I will kind of talk about that in a couple slides. So in our Medicaid program, we have both mandatory and optional Medicaid groups. So a group is a set of people who share similar characteristics. So that would be a child or a pregnant woman. States must provide Medicaid reimbursable healthcare services to all Medicaid mandatory groups if they have a Medicaid program. That's in order to receive that federal matching percentage. States can also elect to cover optional groups as well, but they do have to be approved by the federal government. So once a state elects to cover the optional group, that group is also entitled to receive and get reimbursed services through the Medicaid program. You can see on the slide some examples of some optional groups. One of them is our medically needy program. It's one of the larger optional groups that we have. Another would be a program that we work with the Department of, actually it's the Agency for Persons with Disabilities. It's the iBudget waiver. That is an optional group as well. Another thing to note here is that in addition to laying out mandatory and optional groups, federal CMS, and CMS is the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, that's essentially the regulatory body of all of the Medicaid programs in the nation. They have also identified, they're the ones that identify what the mandatory and optional services are. So this is groups, but we also have mandatory and optional services. A service is a healthcare benefit, such as hospital care or physician care, and the state Medicaid programs are required to cover services or benefits that are designed by CMS to be mandatory. However, we have the option to choose what optional services to cover. But once an optional service is added, everyone who's enrolled in the Medicaid program are entitled to get some of those services there that are optional. They have the right to access those services. Some of the optional services that we have in our Florida Medicaid program are going to be adult vision and hearing services and some physician assistant services. States either must cover mandatory groups up to the minimum income limits that are established by CMS, or they can choose to cover people with higher incomes. So in Florida, most groups are covered at a minimum income limit. So the income level is how much money a person makes based on the federal poverty level, FPL, that's established each year. So I just point you out here. This is just showing what our eligibility is currently for a Florida Medicaid program by the different groups. And on the right is looking at what family incomes would have to be for the federal poverty level. So a family of four, that federal poverty level is $27,750. So most programs are directed by the legislature as to what percentage of the federal poverty level that we should cover. But for parents, they do have a dollar threshold, so the percentage changes when the FPL changes. And states cannot cap their programs, means that for the services in this Medicaid state plan, like hospital services, a state cannot cap either the number of recipients it reserves or the dollar amount that it can spend. So no matter how many people you have, it can't stop the number of services that are rendered for that person. They have to be served. So once that service is in that state plan, a person is eligible for all those services as long as they meet a medically necessary criteria. So services in the state plan must be statewide, available statewide in the same amount, duration, and scope. So as you see on this slide here, this is the income limits currently for the different groups that we have. So I told you that a family of four at the federal poverty level is $27,750. If you look at the pregnant women category here, it's at 185% of the FPL. So that equates to $51,348. That's the income limit for that group. Just want to note that this slide here is based on fiscal year 21-22 data. And this is important information to see because of the impact on the additional enrollments and what that has depends greatly on the growth, what it's made up of, if it's healthy children, if it's elderly adults. Because what you can see here is that children, in terms of the enrollees, make up roughly 50% of all the enrollees. However, their expenditures are 25%, total expenditures. Then you look at the bottom of this chart, you got your elderly and disabled population, which makes up a smaller portion in terms of the enrollees, but a greater portion on the expenditures. So looking at some very high-level estimates, we're taking an estimate from our current state fiscal year, which is 22-23. The current gross per member per year cost for a Medicaid program is $6,783. So per member per year is that for each member that we have on the Medicaid program, it's estimated to cost $6,783 for the whole entire year. So there are a lot of caveats on here that I try to put on the slide because this is a basic simple calculation. It's taking the total expenditures for 22-23, dividing that by the total caseload or enrollment that we have for that year, projected for that year, and you get that number there of $6,783. The total expenditures would also include some other information that may not be directly tied to an individual. So that's why we put these caveats on that figure there, because there is a lot of dollars tied to hospital funding and supplemental type programs that are included in those total expenditures, and there are supplemental programs like for a charity care program. That's not tied to a certain individual Medicaid enrollee. Payments by the federal government for Medicare Part D and mandatory expenditures to cover cost sharing for low-income Medicaid recipients. So those are things that aren't really linked to a direct service. So that's just something I wanted to point out there. Also, the number does not include the money that's repaid back to the state through what we call the Chief Savings Rebate Program, the managed care plans. They go through this process, and they have to pay some dollars back to us based off on some audits that are done. This is through it's a profit-sharing mechanism, and it's called the Achieved Savings Rebate. All right, so this slide is showing over time what the growth in our Medicaid expenditures has been. Going all the way back to, I guess, 87 through current year, and then we do have a projected year on here too in 23-24. As you can see on here, we had a steady incline, but then as you got into 17-18, the growth had kind of started to slow down. So the growth was slowing to some levels that we haven't really seen in the past. Then, however, in 21-22, so really to the end of 20 and into 21-22 fiscal year, it has increased quite a bit. And you see, we have project asterisks over there. Those means that those last 2 years are projected amounts. Those amounts were projected at the August Social Services Estimating Conference. So each year, a couple times a year, the Social Service Estimating Conference convenes to project on estimates for a current budget year and then for the next budget year, the next out year, projects those out for Medicaid expenditures, and that is what the legislature and you guys take into consideration in developing your budgets. And this is based off of August, like I said, within the next couple months. So beginning of March, I believe, we would have another expenditure estimating conference where we have better projections there for both current year and to into 23-24. Very similar slide, but this one is illustrating our caseload. So this is our enrollment in the program. You can see what it's done over the years. What I want to draw your attention to is what occurred really starting in 17-18 through 19-20. There's a decline there. And this is probably the really first time in our Medicaid program where we saw a pretty decent amount of decline and continuing decline. We got down to 3.8 million Medicaid recipients. We did hit the 4 million mark at one point in time in 16-17, but you see we were gradually dropping down to 3.8. And then March of 20 hit, and that was the pandemic started, and we see the increase. Right? The caseload has increased. And you heard your chair talk about that at the beginning, the continuous enrollment. That started at that time, public health emergency started, and we have not been able to disenroll anyone from our program because of the continuous enrollment. So this is where it is. Those last 2 years there, our projections, you do have a drop in 23-24 because we did project a drop in 23-24 back at the July estimating conference. There's an assumption that the public health emergency would end at some point, and we would have made that adjustment there. So looking at this slide, this is doing a comparison of and just putting up against a Florida population up against our Medicaid enrollment, looking at it over 5-year period. So what percent of the Medicaid enrollment is of the total population in Florida? And you can see it has gradually gone up over the 5-year periods with, I did add in here 22-23 at the end. That is using the most recent enrollment data that I have available to us to show that that's where that 25% figure comes from there. All right, so this is what it looks like over the time. And I think, Representative Baker, you had asked me a question earlier this morning about that 25%. You can kind of see on this slide what it has done over the years, how the 25% has not been stagnant. Right, it's grown. Okay, so here's the reality here. For the better part of probably the last couple years, our agency has played the waiting game with the Biden administration on the ending of the public health emergency. You know, the public health emergency has allowed these Medicaid enrollments to just increase drastically here, and is preventing our ability to properly review the income levels of these individuals for our Medicaid population. So as a government agency, we know that we have the fiscal accountability to be good stewards of the taxpayer dollars here and to ensure that those who continue to qualify for Medicaid will receive it. But unfortunately, the Biden administration has prevented us from really doing so. And this slide here is talking about the federal Medicaid assistance percentage from the public health emergency. So what has occurred here in January of 2020, this is when the U.S. Health and Human Services declared a PHE, Congress passed the CARES Act. So with that CARES Act, it provided states a 6.2% increase in that FMAP rate to help with the pandemic. So this enhanced FMAP rate was effective January of 2020 and will end at the end of the PHE, whenever that would be. States accepting that FMAP were required to continuously enroll folks and not basically their eligibility, could not take people off the rolls in order to get that FMAP. All states took that FMAP, and no one has elected to start disenrolling folks. So the FMAP with that 6.2%, I told you what the FMAP was without it. With it, it's 66.25%. So for every dollar, again, for this circumstance, for every dollar, the federal government will pay 66.25 cents, and the state will pay 33.75%. Just wanted to illustrate to you, essentially, in March of 20 versus our enrollments through November, what it has looked like in our program. We have seen a drastic increase in our enrollments. Over 1.8 million new people have come onto our Medicaid enrolls, and that's where we're over now, you know, 5.58 million people. I do have the data for December. Just came in yesterday. We're over 5.6 million folks on the Medicaid program today. You got over 50% increase in the enrollment. Again, we were coming down, and then the pandemic hit, and then it took off from there. So one thing that I want to point out about the overall growth that we have seen during the past 3 years is that the growth has varied, you know, by the different groups. So as I mentioned, overall growth has increased 50%, or roughly 50%, as you can see in that chart there to your right. However, the TANF groups, this is the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families group, increased by 67%, while you have the SSI-related groups, this is the age and blind and disabled folks, they have increased by a lot less, by only 10% here. So generally, the TANF groups are more impacted by changes in the economy than are the other ones. And this is a chart I like to just point out to kind of illustrate that, where you can kind of see this, how the TANF population and the, you know, kind of correlates to the overall size of the program, while when you look at that SSI population, there has not been much change in that throughout the pandemic, and even before that, it's been relatively stable, and it's really that TANF population. So that average caseload is a total caseload for a Medicaid program, and you can kind of chart, it's charting it out through the years, you see how it's kind of increased up, very consistent with what has happened on the TANF side. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will go ahead and turn it on over to Casey Penn at the Department of Children and Families.
Great, and come on up. You're recognized, and please be cognizant of the fact we've got till 5, and I'm sure we'll have a lot of questions.
So. Yes, sir. Chair Fine, Vice Chair Parsons Maluka, committee members, pleasure to be here today. I have the honor of serving as the Assistant Secretary for the Office of Economic Self-Sufficiency. One of the duties that my office has is doing eligibility determinations for Medicaid, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, as well as temporary cash assistance. And so what we're here to talk about today is obviously our Medicaid redetermination process. And for us, it's really getting back to normal operations. This is what we did, and this is how we conducted business prior to the public health emergency, right? And so why we're here today with this date is because the Federal Consolidated Appropriations Act, which was passed December 29th of 2022, untied the continuous enrollment period from the public health emergency. So previously, we were waiting every quarter on the federal government to let us know if they were going to extend the public health emergency or not. And so they promised us 60-day notice. So every quarter, we would wait. We would wait to see if they were going to extend it. And they did, right? So they extended it every time. Now, we had to be prepared to restart our normal operations throughout the last really 2 years. So with this bill that passed, they untied those two together. So you'll see there they did continue an enhanced FMAT rate, but they staggered it kind of down running through December with a decreased amount. And they also provided some provisions on continuing to get that matching rate, such as following the Medicaid eligibility requirements. They have some new requirements that we're still waiting on guidance from. We do hope to get those soon from them as we finalize our plan moving forward. And some of those things are, you know, making good faith efforts on returned mail, certain reporting requirements, different things of that nature. And so we'll get into a lot of that with them later on as we finalize our plan. A couple other things that are not related to the redetermination process is they have extended the coverage for children under the age of 19 to 12 months. It used to be 6 months. So if you're determined eligible, you have a guaranteed 6 months previously, unless you were under 5, and then you were guaranteed a full year. This time you're guaranteed a full year for every child under the age of 19. That coincides with our redetermination period, right? So we conduct redeterminations annually every 12 months. So once we determine you eligible, you're good for another 12 months. So the same there. They also made permanent the state option for postpartum coverage for 12 months. The Florida legislature passed this last year, right? So the state is already doing that. So here's some core tenets for returning to normal Medicaid redetermination process. We know our economy is doing really good in Florida, right? We have record low unemployment. Our wages are up. We should anticipate that our Medicaid, the individuals on Medicaid, follow suit with the rest of our public benefit programs. So if you look at our SNAP program and our TANF program, you know, they went up during the beginning of the public health emergency, and then they slowly went back down to normal things. So because of the requirements on Medicaid, we were not able to disenroll anyone on Medicaid. Now, we still stayed in touch because it was really important to us, and I'll get into this a little bit later, that we had their most up-to-date information because a lot of these individuals have never gone through a redetermination process before. So we tried to stay in touch with them. What's your address? Make sure we have that. What's your income level? Different things of that nature. But here are some of our core tenets as far as returning to normal processes. So we want to prioritize exceptional customer service through strong communication and community collaboration. And I'll delve more into these later on as we go through the slides. We really wanted to leverage technology and operational efficiencies. not just for the Medicaid redetermination period, but for years going forward, right? So if we're going to invest in something right now for this, let's have it bear fruit going forward, because this is part of our normal business operations. And then we wanted to ensure that the coverage for eligible individuals continues, right? So if you're eligible for Medicaid, we want to make sure that you maintain that eligibility and you know the process that you need to do, and also promote the alternative health options for those that are no longer eligible. So here's a couple things that we did and are going to do, really to ensure that Floridians understand the process and have a better experience here with this. So first, we had to put some system protections in place with our technology. We basically hit the pause button on our system for 3 years. And so when you hit start again after 3 years, you got to make sure that when you hit start, people aren't just disenrolled, right? There's a process that we have to do this. There are federal requirements that we have to follow. So we did put some system protections in place. We also really wanted to align individuals' benefit renewal dates. So there's a number of our individuals that receive both SNAP and Medicaid and TANF, and they may have to come in at different points throughout the year to do those eligibility determinations. It's inefficient for us, right? Because, you know, that caseworker is now having to do four different redeterminations when they could do one. We're really using this opportunity to get some efficiencies here, and it's great on the individual as well, because they now just have to interact with the department a single time. We have a well-coordinated communication plan, so we've been working with our industry partners on this. We have detailed communication material for them, because we really want to make sure that we're fully aligned as a state on what we're communicating out to the public. The worst thing we could do is create panic in this process. We have a process. This is back to normal business operations. We want to make sure that we communicate that clearly to individuals, and they understand that if they're still eligible for Medicaid, they can maintain that eligibility, and we're going to supply them with the necessary information to do that. We did a receipt address validation. So one of the main concerns we had was, well, you know, you may not have had to do a redetermination 3 years. Have you moved? Have you changed addresses? Whatnot? We want to make sure that we can contact you in order to do that redetermination. And so we worked with our Medicaid health plans, as well as our EBT vendor, to try to get the most up-to-date address information. We're sending out postcards to all those individuals to say, hey, update your information with us, because when it's time, we want to be able to contact you. We're also doing some targeted call center operations. So not business as normal for our call center, because we know we're probably going to get an influx of calls related to this. So utilizing vendor support and utilizing dedicated staff. We also have a number of self-service options there that we're hoping individuals utilize to get care. And then also stakeholder meetings. So we've already met with associations, plans, different community partners. Really want to get the message out. That way we're coordinated in our communication across the board. So speaking of communication, I talked a little bit about the postcards and the client call center. But we have a Yellow Stripe renewal campaign. So you know, if you get something in the mail, and I'm not sure if you all are like me, but I check my mail like once a week maybe. Because I don't really have a lot of things coming in. We are going to have an envelope that's got a yellow stripe on it, right? So you know, okay, this is about Medicaid, and I probably need to open it up and take action. We're going to have some associated social media campaigns associated with that and whatnot. As far as digital communication goes, one thing we learned through our response to the hurricane is that text message is really the way to contact people. You know, we can send an email, we can send a letter, but if I send someone a text, they're usually going to respond back to it and take action. And then utilizing our IVR obviously is very important to us. And IVR is a virtual call center assistant, so you call in, you can change your address, you can get updated information, you can do a lot of things just right there on that. And then working with our partners, right? So I mentioned before we did that contact information. And we developed partner packets for them. So we did do some technology enhancements. One of the things that we wanted to focus on, as I said before, is making sure that changes that we made to our technology were smart fiscal decisions for the state, and that it wasn't just going to bear fruit just for this redetermination period, that it was going to have benefits moving forward. So one of those processes is an automated renewal process. It's called ex parte. So really fine-tuning the resources and the different sources that we hit for information to determine whether I can say you're eligible or I need to contact you to get some information to determine that. Return mail, there's a lot of federal requirements associated with that are imposed on us. And so we wanted to make sure that we were utilizing automation to be able to provide some efficiencies for us. We do have chatbots and how-to videos online to help to make it easier for customers to update their information. And then we did some system protections, as I said before. All right, so we are going to go through the redetermination process where we, I'll kind of get into the detail of the steps that that takes. But let's say that you're no longer eligible for Medicaid after going through the redetermination process. There's a couple things that are going to happen. If you're under the age, if you're 18 and under, we are going to provide an automated referral over to Florida Healthy Kids or Kid Care, right? And so when that automated referral goes over to Florida Healthy Kids, they're going to get that and they're going to reach out and contact that individual. They've done some improvements on their end and some efficiencies on their end to utilize the eligibility information that we've done to speed that process up, right, for helping get those families enrolled in alternative forms of healthcare. If you're an adult, you are going to be referred to other federally subsidized health programs, and they will reach out to you with information that they have, or you'll be referred to the medically needy program. Basically, what that means is you have to meet your share of cost through the month before Medicaid kicks in, and there are certain eligibility requirements for that. Obviously, there's commercial coverage as well. I think it's safe to assume that a lot of the individuals that got on Medicaid during the public health emergency, based on what our low unemployment rate is, now have jobs, and maybe they have health coverage with that, or they're getting health coverage in other areas, and then they're federally qualified health centers. So there are places that you can show up, and get services there in the community. So now we're going to get into kind of the meats and potatoes on how we're going to do this, right? So we have a prioritization schedule for conducting these redeterminations. As I mentioned before, we have stayed in contact with our customers throughout in order to get up-to-date information. We have around 900,000 individuals that we know the last time we talked to them, they're no longer eligible for Medicaid. Those are going to go first. So we're prioritizing those first. Number one, it's fiscally responsible, right, for the state in order to stop paying capitation rates on those individuals as they transition into other forms of healthcare, right? Next, we have individuals that we contacted and we didn't get back any information on them, so they're kind of in an unknown status, and so that's going to be the next priority group that goes. And then after that, we are going to align SNAP and TANF Medicaid cases together, so we just have a single review date for a family. The last priority group for us is the most vulnerable. So those children with complex medical cases, things like that, those are going last in this process to ensure that we communicate fully with them and they understand what their requirements are. So here's a timeline of kind of what it looks like to do a redetermination. And I know this is a busy slide, so I'll help explain it a little bit. So prior to the March date, there's a lot of things that happen prior to the first slide, right? So there's a lot of technology improvements and things of that nature that we're doing. But the federal government basically said, look, in April, you can begin to do redeterminations. That redetermination has requirements. So we have to send a notice to an individual. That individual, well, actually, first, and you'll see there, March 1st, we do an ex parte case review, which I was talking about, the auto approval process. So we're going to hit the different sources of data and determine whether or not you even need to contact us. Do we know that you're already eligible and you maintain your eligibility based on the data that we have and based on verified sources of data such as income and things of that nature? If we can't automatically renew you, we're going to send you a notice, and that notice goes out 45 days prior to your coverage ending. That notice is going to be in a yellow striped envelope. We're also going to send text messages, which we haven't done previously, but we're going to do this time, as well as emails to individuals so they understand, hey, you need to take action. Log into your MyAccess page, update your information. If we don't hear from someone around the 19th or 20th of the month that your coverage expires, we're going to send you another letter, and that letter is going to say your coverage is ending. You need to take action. If you don't want your coverage to end, you need to take action. Now, let's say for some reason we don't get a response from that individual. There are protections in place. They do get 90 days post that. If they are eligible and they do apply within those 90 days, their coverage is retroactive. So say you forget to send in your redetermination notice, you go to the doctor the following month, the doctor tells you you're no longer on Medicare, right? You don't have coverage, Medicaid. You don't have coverage. You can submit an application at that point in time. If you're eligible, your coverage will be retroactive to the date that it ended because you didn't submit that notice. So this process follows every month, and you'll see in there, we're really prioritizing individuals As you see that FMAP process percentage go down, like we want to make sure that we're being good fiscal stewards and that we're prioritizing those that need to transition over to a different form of healthcare while maintaining those that are eligible, maintain their benefits. So here's a couple just examples of the redetermination process. So in the first instance there, you're going to see we did an ex parte review and it came back approved. That individual doesn't need to do anything. They're going to automatically be approved for another 12 months. Let's say you have a family and we can't automatically renew you. We're going to send you a notice. If you send us the information back and we can validate that you're eligible for Medicaid, you're going to maintain your benefits, right? Let's say the third scenario there, you send us, we can't auto-renew you. We send out information, you send it back to us, and we determine that you do not meet the eligibility requirements. Two things are going to happen, which I talked about before. If you're an adult, you're going to get referred to subsidized federal health programs. If you're a kid, you're going to get referred over to Florida Healthy Kids, and they're going to make contact with you. So partnership is really important in this. There are a number of partners that we have through Medicaid, specifically our Medicaid health plans, different community organizations. We really want to make sure that they're in lockstep with us from a communication standpoint. Right now, up until we start doing redeterminations, it's really important that we get the most up-to-date information for individuals. So anyone that's on Medicaid, you need to log into your My Access account online, and you make sure your address is right, because we're going to be contacting you with information. That's also a way for you can log in and see, when your redetermination date is going to be. Now, you can't see that now, but you can later on, right? And we're going to be sending you information, text messages, things of that nature to let you know when's the right time to look at your account for what information. For our partners, they can sign up and stay informed on our website and make sure that we have a constant loop. So what's next? Well, we're still waiting on some federal guidance on a couple items. We hope to get that cleared up shortly from them. Supposedly within this month, we're gonna get some finality on what the requirements that they wanna make sure that we're doing with this process. For our Medicaid recipients, as I just said before, update your address, please. And then be on the lookout for the yellow stripe envelope and make sure we have the right phone number for you. And then for our partners, sign up for that distribution list. We'll send you a partner packet that's got a very strong communication plan in it. It's going to give you sample text messages, sample emails, questions and answers that you may get from constituents on this or from customers. And so really want to make sure everyone's informed on that. Thank you, Chair Fine.
All right, thank you both for your presentation, your joint presentation. Well, now we've got about 35 minutes left for questions from members. So I'm going to start with Rep. Koster, but if you want to sort of look down at me and wave, I can add you to the list.
Thank you, Chair, and I actually have two questions, one for each presenter. So
sounds good. Go for it.
Okay. So first, and this is maybe a silly question, and perhaps I'm showing my ignorance, but how do folks know that the yellow stripe on the envelope means that it's something important for Medicaid?
Yeah, so we're going to have a targeted social media campaign.
You're recognized.
I'm sorry, Chair.
All right.
My apologies. Chair, fine. we're going to have a social media campaign where we really get the word out. We're going to work with community partners so they can get the word out in the community with their individuals so they know, like, look out for this.
And you had a second question?
I did, and this one was for Tom. So there was some reference to text messages and making sure that these folks update their contact information. And one of the questions I had is, I've heard from some of the plans, the managed care plans, that they are not permitted to require an enrollee to provide an email and cell phone number. And I'm wondering, do you know if there's something that prohibits the plans from requiring that information from enrollees? Because I'm hearing one of the issues is that some of these folks tend to be somewhat transient, particularly with the amount of time that's gone by, and contacting them is difficult. I'm hearing that that the department is able to have cell phone and email address. I don't know, why can't the plans require that information from their enrollees? Seems to me like this day and age, that's the easiest way to get a hold of folks.
You're recognized.
Thank you, and thank you for that question. I need to go back and exactly look at that, with the plans, but what I can say, that has been a more of a guidance on the CMS side where text messaging has come up where they hadn't really I don't know the details on it, but I think they kind of prohibited plans reaching out to members via text message and doing that. But now with this, as we're moving forward, we are getting some maybe clearer guidance from CMS that they will maybe allow that in the future. And so that's just something we're looking at as we work with CMS on.
Brett Masullo, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also have two questions. Commissioner, my first question is to you. You talked a little bit about the waiver program and different options that you have that are available to all enrollees. How easy is it for the state to add or delete options from that program?
You're recognized.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that question. I think what you're referring to is optional groups and optional services, how to delete programs from there. It's really typically it would be a legislative action. You know, legislature would direct the agency to no longer cover that group, so to speak. One of the other optional groups is our 19 to 20-year-olds. They're considered optional. That is a group that could be eliminated because federal government's not mandatory. So it could be eliminated, but with the state wouldn't just come out and do that. We would look for direction from the legislature.
You have a second question? Go ahead.
Thank you for the follow-up, Mr. Chair. My next question is to you, sir, and thank you for meeting with me today, by the way. I really appreciate it. Out of those 900,000 people, and you said the state's cost is about $6,783, that's almost $6 billion total of money that we might be spending on people that probably shouldn't be on Medicaid. Do we have any associations with any ancillary agencies, like, for instance, driver's license or something that you could access for demographics? And getting hold of some of these people if you can't get them via the current addresses that we have?
You're recognized, and I'm going to do a little math exercise in a little while. So you're recognized.
Yes, thank you. Your question is more on the how do we make sure that we can contact that group, right? So the good news is that group of folks we do have good information on because we've contacted them and we have we can validate certain things, right? So you're either over income, your children are over age. Whatever it may be. We did do an address validation campaign with this, but we do have access to different sources that we utilize to try to contact them. Also, you know, if we get a return mail, we process that in the system and send something back out. So we also utilize the post office service for things of that nature.
Thanks. Representative Tribulsi, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I just have a quick question. In relationship to your redetermination notices via text messaging and social media, and even through the mail, are you taking into consideration the different languages that are spoken in Florida, and how are you sending that out and addressing it?
You're recognized.
Thank you. Yes, we have information in English, Spanish, and Creole. And so when we send out information, we have the ability to send it in all of those languages. And when they access their account, they can access their account in those languages as well. So they'll be able, it'll be translated for them.
Yeah. Representative Cross, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you both for that presentation. If I could have a couple questions, I have about 10 listed, but I'll go to like two of them. First of all,
I'll ask a couple and I'll come back to you. Okay. I need a few minutes at the end, but.
Got it. So the 6.2% additional from the federal government, do you have an estimate of what that was in dollar amounts coming to the state over the past couple years?
You're recognized. Sure.
Thank you. Thanks for that question. That's 6.2%. We've been receiving that since early 2020. And just kind of looking at what that correlates to. So what that does is obviously there's more federal dollars coming in. State dollars have gone down with that 6.2%, right? So that's how it translates into, and you know, I gave you that example of that 6.2%. So for every $1, you know, you got that extra 6.2% on it rather than, and so the state had to put in less.
Follow up.
Okay. Relating to the eligibility during the public health emergency, was there anything that changed about the eligibility requirements, such as the income level, or was it simply that there were more people who were at or below those poverty thresholds?
Sure. You're recognized.
Thank you, and thank you for that question. The eligibility did not change. So nothing with the eligibility adjusted at all. We had to maintain the current eligibility that we had.
Just to help on that, I think the change was the eligibility requirements didn't change, but these programs are called temporary. And so someone might have had a job challenge or something, but once they're on it, even if they won the lottery or went back to their job, they still were on it. So it's not necessarily tied to the economy. It's once on, not off.
Right.
So that's great. Do you want to ask another one? Okay, great. Representative Edmonds, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm new to this committee, so I'm sorry if this is a silly question. So I'm 31. I'm not married. I don't have any kids. Say if I was under the federal poverty line, are there any services for someone like me in the category?
Not really the subject of our presentation. Maybe the right question is, are you eligible, or would you be eligible for Medicaid? Would be a good...
That's what I'm asking. Is there anything that covers someone my age range that... I understand it's for pregnant women, those with families, those with kids. Is there any services for those who are doesn't have kids and not married?
You're recognized.
Thank you, and thank you for that question. Really, for adults that are... what you just described there, it's not really much available at all there.
Follow-up?
Is there ever going to be maybe a strategy to include someone like me in that category? Or is this just for the most vulnerable population?
Recognizing you all don't set policy, you're welcome to try to answer that question.
Right. Thank you. Thank you for that question. We would just wait to see what came out of the legislative session. You know, if the legislature determined to make some adjustment there, we can go ahead and apply that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Gant, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, gentlemen, for your presentation. Mr. Chair, I have two questions. Is that okay?
That's fine.
Thank you. My first question is in regards to slide 9. For the parents, caretakers, children ages 19 through 20, it says for the federal poverty level, it says fixed dollar amount. What is that? What does that look like? Or what is it and how is it determined?
You're recognized.
Thank you. And thank you for that question. So the federal poverty limits are all determined. You know, we go out there, we get them down. The states do not determine this at all here. But this is saying this is a fixed dollar amount for this portion here. And so what happens with this is that it adjusts annually based off of whatever the income level is of the federal poverty level. So we're not changing that. So they got percentages here for all these other items, but this one is that fixed dollar amount, $4,368. This is the amount that for this group that income needs to be for them to qualify.
Okay.
Do you have a follow-up?
Yes, yes.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the end of the presentation, it said community partners can sign up for a distribution list to get information to disseminate that to our constituents. How do we sign up for that list?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. If you go to www.myflfamilies.com/Medicaid, you'll be able to get all the information, particularly in regards to this redetermination process. But there's a gov delivery that you can sign up for that. You all can also are welcome to reach out to me at any point in time, and I'm happy to share what information.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Woodson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you both for your presentation. And I know, Mr. Commissioner, we have had you earlier, but I have a question for you on slide 7. May I be recognized for two questions, Mr.
You
Chair?
Can.
Thank you so much. On page 7, where we have the optional and the mandatory ones category, the groups, the different groups. For the breast and cervical cancer program enrollees, we know a large number of women are impacted by breast cancer and cervical cancer as well, and some men are also affected by cancer. And you mentioned that the state has the discretion to move this group from one group to another, right? Is that correct?
You recognize. Sure.
They are optional, so it stays in the optional category. We're not. They get services through this program. It's not moving to mandatory, if that's what you're asking.
I think you meant that the state had the... It wasn't required that the state do this. That's what he means by optional, and the state's chosen to offer
to do it.
This program.
Okay.
So in order to be in Medicaid, you have to do these mandatory groups. And then the federal government has said, hey, if you want, we'll keep paying our 60%. It's up to you. But, and these five examples at the bottom are things where the legislature has chosen to do these things and this and with the federal government's consent.
Okay.
That's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask them from that group, from that optional group to the mandatory one. That was going to be my question.
So it's required it's to be in Medicaid versus you can do it.
Because that's very important. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, may I ask the second question? For the part that you mentioned that you are working, and I know you're doing everything that you can to reach out to the recipients in order to make sure that they are redetermined, is there a linkage or partnership with the various county agencies, since I know it's the state and we have worked in partnership with DCF at the county level? Most of those recipients who receive Medicaid, they also access county services. Do you intend to have a partnership with the different county agencies in order for you to get those that you are unable to find, besides the community partners that you are reaching out to?
You're recognized.
Thank you. That's a great question. We are hoping any and all partner with us on this endeavor, and so we welcome partnership from all the counties on getting the word out and ensuring that those individuals understand what's going to be required of them and that they update their information. So, yes, we would be open definitely to meeting with the counties on that.
Please do.
Okay.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other members who have not asked questions yet who want to? And okay. Representative Cross, did you have any other questions you wanted to ask? We have a couple minutes. If not, that's no one's going to complain, but if you want to. What? You're done? Okay. I have a couple questions I'd like to go back to page 17, if that's okay. You guys cycle back on the slides up there. So the number I want to focus in on is the 1,682,000 number, because I think the reason for the difference in growth is no one got older, blind, or disabled, you know, generally because of the public health emergency. Once you are, right? There's no disenrollment. And that went up by 8%, but the other number, it went up by 67%. I'd also note that one is much less expensive than the other, I think, as you pointed out before. Of that 1.7 million growth, how you said you know 900,000 are not eligible. What is your estimate of the remaining 700,000 and change that are not eligible as well? You're recognized. You can just answer my question.
Thank you.
I don't need to ask and then recognize you. You can just answer.
So we have around another 850,000 that we don't know. We're anticipating. There's a number of reasons you may not have reached back out to us. One, you knew we couldn't disenroll you, so you didn't have to. You could not need it anymore and aren't paying attention to that, those notices. The rest of our public benefits have leveled out, right, from what they were before. So I think it's reasonable to expect that we could see the same thing in the Medicaid program when this happens.
Okay, so some of this, it's not just, it's 900,000 plus some amount of 780,000 as well, right? So it's you think there's a reasonable chunk. Okay. So I want to estimate the cost to do this. Now, the Biden administration, as you pointed out, said we couldn't do this until April 1st. But after April 1st, we can. And so I did a quick estimate so people can think about the budgetary impact of this. If it's $223 a month, as you put up there, to keep someone in that cheaper category, and a million of them, of that 1.7, no longer qualify. So I think I'm being pretty conservative, only 100,000 of the remaining 700,000. And the state's paying 35% of that, which is a sort of weighted average of that amount. That works out to $78 million per month. That's not the cost of Medicaid. That's the state part of the cost of Medicaid. And that, let's remember, that's $78 million per month that either we have to make it more expensive to live in Florida to collect. We have to go get that from taxpayers, higher taxes, those kinds of things, or that's $78 million that we can't spend to do something else. And I often think about the Medicaid waiver, you know, program and those folks that we have not had enough money to take care of. So $78 million a month on people who do not qualify for this welfare program. Does my estimate seem reasonable? 35% of $223 times a million people per month? Does that seem reasonable?
I get the math. I understand what you're saying there. In terms of reasonable, we haven't gone back and done any kind of analysis or
sure. Calculation. Just the back of the envelope, but it just to give people a sense, we're not talking about little amounts of money. $78 million is a lot of money. And by the way, if we were to take a year, it would be almost $1 billion. To put things in perspective, with $1 billion, we could effectively take everyone off the Medicaid waiver list who's on it. So my question is, these 900,000 people, will they all be off by April 1st? So we're not having to spend $78 million to give welfare benefits to people who don't qualify?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's something that we definitely took into account when we were doing our priority groups. There are federal processes that we have to follow in order to do this, which are cumbersome and time-consuming, and we run relatively lean, right, as an agency. We anticipate doing 300,000 cases a month. That's our capacity that we're going to be able to do, because we also do SNAP and TANF and other things. But that 300,000 isn't just 300,000 people, because there are more people within those cases. So, you know, we have 5.5 million individuals on Medicaid, but we have 3.6 million cases. And so that's why that was prioritized. You know, within the first quarter, we anticipate any individual that was in that population, that their situation didn't change and they're still ineligible, to be transitioned over a different form of healthcare.
So it sounds like what you're saying is sort of in the first 2 to 3 months, you'll be able to get that it's 300,000 cases, but the average case is more than 1.0, right. Can't be less. So right. If it's 1.5, you could do it in 2 months. Okay,
yes.
So I understand. So a couple of months, keeping them on. And then the focus is moving on to the other potentially 700,000. And those other 700,000, when would the last, and again, some of them may still qualify, but let's assume of those who don't, when would the last of them cycle off and we not be paying for money that we could spend on other things?
Yeah, another couple months, right? So, I mean, it's relatively same population size within those two groups. I mean, the second group will be moved through a little bit quicker. But within, you know, within 2 to 3 months on the first group and then another 2 months or so for the second.
So you had a bullet in your plan that said people would get disenrolled sort of on their anniversary date if you didn't know that information. It was on page 25. So I just want to make, so that, again, so if someone is not in that first 900,000, they're in the remaining X from 0 to 750,000, and their enrollment date originally was March 15th. Will they be getting it until March 15th of 2024, again, at taxpayer expense of 35% a month, or will you sort of be trying to accelerate to get folks off of Medicaid that do not qualify as soon as possible? Are we gonna let that person stay on until March 15th?
Thank you, sir. And let me clarify that on this slide, because you bring up a really great point. If we do not know, like if we try to reach out to you and you didn't, and we don't have any contact information from you, or you did not reach back out to us, so we don't know your eligibility status, you're gonna be moved to the front of the line. That bullet right there is for the remaining population, the ones that we know are eligible. You're gonna maintain your eligibility date unless we can align you with your SNAP and TANF case if you so happen to have one of those. That way you only have to come into the department once and we can create some efficiencies in our process as well.
Okay, and as you request moving forward, as you get more clarity on the exact number of people and the dates of disenrollment for things like budgeting processes and other things, if we can get that, because at least my perspective is, you know, I'd rather be spending $78 million a month on people who need our help than people who don't qualify for it and or, you know, making it more affordable to live in Florida, something I know that we're all concerned about. So thank you for coming in and giving this presentation today. We certainly do appreciate it. So that concludes our business for today. I will say we will be meeting next week, and I think the notice should already be out, or if it's not, it will be out soon. So I don't think I'm giving up any secrets, but we're gonna meet next week, and we will be having a panel next week on PBMs, so, which is something that's sort of been in the news a lot lately, trying to hear all perspectives from all sides. We'll have a panel discussion with the various constituencies next week. So with that, that concludes our meeting agenda. With that, Leader Grant moves we rise. Without objection, the meeting is adjourned.